Right, so we were talking about warfare, and we talked, we looked at some of the sort of few remaining hunter-gatherer-esque type groups. So things like Papua New Guinea, the highlands of New Guinea still have a few of these, certain areas of Indonesia, a few South American groups as well. Still, what we're seeing here is that non-industrialized human warfare is actually, in fact, quite destructive. And contrary to sort of, shall we say, 18th, 19th, early 20th century, you know, industrialized warfare, more of a traditional or non-industrialized approach says that there are no non-combatants. Everybody can be killed. Women, children, people in camps, wipe them out. Okay. Now, you say, okay, well, still, as we've discussed, some of the argument that has been made is that you only get into warfare if we're dealing with some having more resources and some having less. In other words, this is perhaps a modern issue, perhaps certainly post-EEA, once we at least start having some sort of settlements, and we could, in fact, make the argument that, as we've said, the remaining hunter-gatherer groups have been quite marginalized, and marginalized for now many centuries, such that they're not able to go anywhere else. They're not able to leave a territory, establish in a new location, simply because there are just too many people, and they've been pushed into very poor areas, so they may be forced into this kind of conflict. In other words, perhaps it is not actually a, you know, quote-unquote natural pattern of behavior for humans. So let's take a look at evidence from definitely prehistory. Let's go back tens, hundreds of thousands of years here. Now, doing this, we take a look at archaeological fossil evidence of Homo erectus skeletal findings. Number of skulls have been recovered, have been found, have been dug up, and many of them have what would be readily recognized by any modern forensics expert. So, you know, if you were to give this to the CSI Vegas kind of group, you know, they'd look at this and go, oh, yeah, that's a depression fracture caused by a club or a staff. So, in other words, what we've got is a series of our ancestors from at least 750,000 years ago who were being killed by clubs. Now, the only species that actually effectively makes use of clubs is us. Something in the Homo, well, and presumably Homo erectus. We would have had that nice opposable thumb, enlarging cranium, capacity to fashion. They had other tools. So this would be a fact that we have our Homo erectus ancestors that were killing one another off with tools. So it's not accidental, right? It's not like, oh, you just walked into the door jamb of the cave, you know? No. All right. Also, so not looking at skulls, but looking at long bones, like leg bones, arm bones, whatnot, many have been recovered that have a very indicative pattern of cuts in them. Now, anyone hunt? Nobody hunts. Okay. Well, if you hunt, if you got a deer or something, you deflesh the animal. You take them, that's the meat, muscles off the animal, so you're using knives to cut that off. This leads to a pattern of very characteristic cut marks in the bones. So, not only were our ancestors killing one another, they were butchering one another as well. Now, we don't know why. We do. The obvious reason for it, we've got at least a fairly reasonable inference here. If you're going to butcher somebody or something, the reason for that is eating it. We don't know why. So this indicates cannibalism. It could be that it was ritualistic, or it could be very opportunistic. So we do know this from groups in Papua New Guinea that even up until the 1950s would engage in cannibalism of other individuals they killed in combat. It could be for food resources. Yeah.
Could it also be secondary burial? A lot of people nowadays also just like turn the body for.
Yes, that's yep, that's an interesting point. There are cultures now that will deflesh bodies for various culture-specific types of burial. So that's a possibility. The remains have been found from numerous locations that are quite geographically isolated, and so it's possible, but given the different areas, environments, time frames, it would require that you've got a whole bunch of different Homo erectus cultures all coming up with similar burial practices. So it's possible that it could account for some, but a more parsimonious explanation with which fits with other modern and within recent history hunter-gatherers is that this is for food source. But it could be very ritualized, or it could strictly be, woohoo, food.
We don't know. We don't know that.
If we take a look at Homo sapiens neanderthalus, Neanderthals used to be considered to be Homo neanderthals, so a separate species. They're now generally considered to be a subspecies. So Homo sapiens neanderthalus, and we're Homo sapiens sapiens. Looking at remains of Neanderthals recovered from between 100 to 40,000 years ago, so certainly overlapping our roughly 200,000 year existence, a number of skeletal remains have been found that show obvious evidence of death by weapon, including things like spear wounds. In at least one case that I'm familiar with, the spear point was actually lodged in the ribs, so the broken spearhead was actually found with the remains. Also mass burials, where numerous skeletons were found together. The most likely reason for mass burials is a whole bunch of people were killed at once. If it's not found someplace associated with like a river, so trying to ford a river, getting caught in the flood and all going under at the same time, generally the best explanation for mass burials is a whole bunch of people killed by other people in a very short period and dumped there and buried to keep scavengers, carrion eaters from coming by and bothering you. About 5%, roughly, well, maybe a little bit more, of the Neanderthal burials show marks of human directed violence towards them. If we fast forward, you heard of the Iceman found in the Alps, Italian Swiss Alps, about, what was this, mid-90s, late-90s? Some tourists were wandering around, frozen in a glacier for about, oh gosh, what was it? Something like roughly 8,000 odd years, something like that. Thawed out. They thought it was initially a hiker or somebody who fell into a crevasse. Turns out 8,000 odd year old human. So more recent here. But in terms of his accoutrements, clothing, food resources, these sorts of things, coming from not sort of the Mediterranean area, so not coming out of an area that had gotten into major agriculture here, probably more based on a hunting-gathering tribal sort of structure, he died from human-inflicted wounds. That being said, he probably took somebody with him because the knife he was carrying had human blood on it, not his. So he died of stab wounds. So presumably reconstructing this, fight occurred, he wounds or kills somebody, escapes, but dies from wounds received during the fight as well, which is frozen to a glacier. So, kind of violence is not atypical, it seems. History and archaeological evidence is not on the side of people like Lorenz and others who suggest that violence directed towards members of your own species is an abnormality. This is something we have been doing for a very, very, very long time. Now, you might say, okay, what about Lorenz's kind of statement that you don't find things like tigers or wolves generally killing each other off? Let's talk a little about that. Let's talk about predators here. Predators are very good at killing other things. They have to be. They're predators. They're carnivores. If you can't kill inter-specifically, that is, if you can't kill a member of another species, you're probably not going to be very good at killing members of your own species. So something like cows. Cows are not particular, or even if we take something that's a little wilder, like a, say, a Cape buffalo, not particularly good at killing. I mean, a lot of bugs, you know, get eaten when they're just eating grass, or you know, some little snake gets stepped on by a water buffalo. But, I mean, it's pretty unintentional, right? Most herbivores make atrocious at killing. And consequently, we don't actually see much in the way of intraspecific violence within herbivorous species. That seems to come with the carnivorous and at least omnivorous species. Okay, but if we look at this, we don't see that all predators will engage in what we might describe as warfare. So things like tigers and eagles and weasels. Pound for pound, weasels are ferocious. Based on body mass, comparing them, I mean, if you were to scale a weasel up, I mean, oh good gods, that's like worse than some sort of, you know, Harry Potter dragon or something. I mean, they're vicious creatures that have way too much energy, very sharp teeth, and a very high metabolic rate. It just consistently, stunningly amazes me that people keep ferrets as pets. They're just voracious predators. But they rarely, they'll take down things way bigger than they are. But they rarely go after one another. Same with tigers and, you know, tigers and eagles and weasels, oh my. They rarely will kill members of their own species off. The best explanation for this is there's frankly just too much risk. If you're dealing with two killing machines that are specifically, you know, both relatively fit members of their own species, odds are they're both going to die, or at least one of you is going to die pretty immediately, and another one's going to be so weakened that may die later. So let's talk humans for a little bit. I like swords. I always have. Since I was 12, done things with swords and various types of either Olympic-style fencing or more recently Western martial arts, things like that. And background in history means I've read a bunch of stuff. So if we take a look at duels, okay, so say 16th, 17th, 18th century duels. There's actually a surprisingly large amount of material written about this and actually on this from people that participated in duels, observed duels, eventually perhaps died of duels as well. Now, if we look at this, the kind of movie version that you get that is often portrayed, especially working with swords, is ting, 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 blah, someone gets stabbed, they drop down to the ground dead. Few heroic final words, and that's it. This is not actually the historic case. Unless the two combatants were so stunningly mismatched that one was very good with the sword and one was very bad, you rarely got that. It was actually not uncommon for both people that were fighting a duel to generally die. One at the duel site from wounds received then, the next, within the next couple of weeks, due to post-wound infection. It was very rarely, if you had two relatively competent duelists who knew how to use their weapons, it was rare for one to get away scot-free. They'd both be cut to pieces. And not just cutting, biting, ripping off ears, breaking of fingers, all kinds of things. I will say this for the Europeans. They never sort of stylized or glamorized combat into some sort of pseudo-spiritual process like, say, Eastern cultures did with ideas of chi and mysticism of samurai and these sorts of things. Western combat was savage, brutal. Oh, what was the line from, you know, brutal, savage, short? It was designed to put somebody else down very, very hard. But if you had two relatively comparable individuals fighting, big risk. Which is, in fact, why ultimately, by the 18th century, they were bringing in sort of rules such that duels would often stop at first blood, because frankly, within France, between the 17th and 18th century, something like 20% of the upper classes were killed, males, not the females. Upper class females were being killed in duels. They were just bleeding the nobility out with this. So they brought various other processes in. If you're good at killing, it doesn't make sense to kill or try to fight with others that are just as good as you are. Now, when we do find, so you say, so what? None of the, are we back to just people and ants? No, we've seen that primates will do this. We've talked about lions. So I said with lions, one pride of lions will, if they find a lioness from another pride by herself, they'll pick her off. And this is what we tend to see. When we find carnivores and omnivores that will kill interest specifically, they tend to do it in a very similar way to the hunter-gatherers that we discussed. Ambushes. Attack from position of power. If you outnumber the other one, take somebody out from another group with relatively little risk to yourself. So we tend to see this in groups that have at least loosely related kinship bonds within the social structure. We also see this in groups that have generally that we've got different groups in close proximity of variable size. So if you've got different sizes of the groups, this is going to put pressure. One group's going to try to take more of the territory, more of the resources. The more resources you can bring into your own group, the greater the survival of your offspring is going to be. The more of that group's genes, and because of kinship, the more your genes are going to spread. So opportunities that are presented, especially if you have size disparities between groups in close proximity, means that we can get into this sort of process. If one group has got a few more individuals, they'll work more together, pick off individuals from another group. If you eventually kill off enough of them, that group either collapses or is forced to leave or becomes subsumed within your own group, and the benefits are conferred upon you, the individual, and other members of your group. So we see this in lions, hyenas, wolves, chimpanzees, and human hunter-gatherers. Also, modern human gangs, for example. Gangs, mobs, whatever you want to call this, biker groups, same process. Try to kill individuals from another group with relatively little risk to yourself. Now, because of this, then we see, as we've seen through a lot of other things, competition for resources. Again, going back to Tangled Bank concept, you're in competition with other members of your species that need the same things that you need. So if you can reduce the membership of another group, this gives your group an advantage. Now, looking at the things I've described here, lions, hyenas, wolves, these sorts of species, they maintain a kinship structure, chimpanzees, kinship structure within the group. So even if, and I should say that generally what we see here is the adult members of the group that will go out, patrol together, hunt together, stop together, do whatever, are generally fairly closely related, even within the group. They tend to work within very close kinship bounds here. Looking at this then, if the group as a whole does well, I mean, again, we're not getting into a group selection process here. We don't have to postulate that. If the group does well, so do the individuals within the group. They have a high kinship relationship. Their genes are going to propagate. Even if you die, so let's imagine you're part of a little group that's ambush attacking some other group. Even if you die then, but your group wins, your genes are still, through indirect fitness, going to continue to propagate. So, yeah, there's a risk, but from the evolutionary perspective, no, I mean, sucks to be you, you just died, right? Sorry, so sad, too bad. But from the evolutionary perspective, as long as your genes continue to propagate, and remember, selfish gene interpretation here, the vehicle is ephemeral and expendable. What's important are the eternal genes. Okay. So, we get this pattern. Kill if the opportunity arises, and the risk is low. Otherwise, don't. And that's what we see. We see this in the non-humans. We see it in modern human groups, either hunter-gatherer or subsets within industrialized cultures as well. So any questions on that? Okay. Like I said, not much in the text on this, but it's an interesting topic, and with all the things kind of going on in the world recently, with warfare, rebellions, revolutions, civil wars, however you want to describe them, start thinking about that and looking at this in terms of these social structures and organizations, and start to see patterns here. All right. I just want to finish up by talking about something else here fairly quickly, and that's called dominant systems. We said from the very beginning that mammals have a rather unusual approach, and that we have these cross-generational matrilineal bonds, and that we've talked at various points about how you have female-female alliances, male-male alliances, and male-female alliances within inside humans. I just want to talk briefly a little bit more about these dominant systems. We've talked about politics as well, and said politics is just, if you will, establishing hierarchies in any sort of social grouping. So, dominant systems then really are involved in a within-group regulation of hierarchy. Broadly speaking, there are two types of division. We can talk about what are called despotisms and hierarchical structures. A despotism actually is a hierarchy where there is one individual, or maybe one individual and a few supporters, that are at the top, and everyone else is at the bottom. So it is a hierarchy, but it's a very curtailed hierarchy. In a hierarchical structure, there are generally multiple levels of social status, significance, and even within a level, there may be other divisions. So we can have vertical structures. So campus. So on campus, right? There's the university president. Then there's the vice presidents. Then there's the deans of faculties, the chairs of departments, professors, postdocs, graduate students, undergrads. Okay, so that's a hierarchy in terms of, you know, who has power within the system. So that would be what we'd see as a vertical hierarchy. But even within a level, so consider chairs, department chairs, right? I mean, the chair of a department with only, you know, five faculty and, you know, maybe 14 graduate students is going to have a lot less sway and power in the university, even at the level of other chairs, than a chair who has, you know, a department that has 110 faculty and 300 graduate students. So, you know, that's, well, they're all chairs, but who's got more clout? Okay. So that would be then a horizontal division of power there, dominance within one of the vertical structures. We can also talk about in humans what are called absolute and relative dominance hierarchies. In an absolute hierarchical system, your status is determined by where you fit exactly in the hierarchy. Now, things may change, and you may be able to move up or slide down depending on circumstances, but your status is what it is based upon where you are at this particular point in time. In a relative dominance hierarchy, this may shift depending upon the circumstances. So you may have somebody who, in, say, a tribal setting, is the best tracker, all right? But otherwise, you know, not particularly good at a lot of other stuff. So that tracker's status may be of a particular level, perhaps a little bit lower in the overall social hierarchy, maybe a bit asocial, doesn't do a good job at Machiavellian intelligence, not very good. But when it comes time to go out hunting and you need the tracking skills, that tracker suddenly gets bumped up in hierarchy and becomes in charge of the hunting group. But as soon as you get back to camp, status drops back down. So that would be a relative dominance hierarchy. Oh, you know, you see this, you say, well, it's tribes, and what about university system? Anyone have to do an intro physics course with a lab? things sliding and bonking into stuff and momentums and stuff like that. You know, do that. I remember that. You look at it, it's like, what the heck are we doing here? You know, it's a bunch of weights sliding and bonking. Right? And then you get the Star Trek geek that's there. It's like, oh yeah, no, this is exactly like episode 46 when Kirk had to slingshot the Enterprise around the sun. Wait, you actually understand this? Yeah, it's really easy. He's in our group. Tragically, after the physics lab is done, you know, it's like, so we can all like hang out, right? It's like, no. But sad geek, all right? But you know, within geeks. Okay, so relative status changes, all right? So, we have that. We don't tend to see that in non-humans. That's kind of a pretty uniquely human sort of thing. Yeah. Absolute means that if you have a particular status in the social hierarchy, that is what it is. It won't shift by a new task coming along. So if it was an absolute status, if you're a Star Trek geek, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you're in physics class or an English class or anywhere else. Your social status is perhaps still low. All right? I'm not mocking Star Trek geeks, you know, I was one and probably still am considered to be one, so anyways. That would be an issue there. In say, the university hierarchy, you may have, vice president of finance, fairly highly rated for the university. Vice President of Research, pretty highly rated. VP, the communication side of things, not really as, unless suddenly something drops into the pot and we've got a bit of a faux pas scandal that's going to reflect very badly on the university, like, for example, the Dean of Medicine. Anyone following that? Yeah, Dean of Medicine plagiarized his commencement address to med students the other day. Yeah, epic fail. Because frankly, if one of his students had done that, he would have been expelled. So we should expel the dean. Well, at that point, suddenly someone who's involved in communications suddenly gets popped up. Maybe not even at the level of the VPs. You know, somebody suddenly from communications is university communications director is coming in and being able to order the vice presidents and possibly even the president of the university around in terms of what they should be doing. So that would be a relative situation there. Okay. So what we're seeing here in any dominant system is we have individuals that are more dominant, those that are less dominant, and the less dominant ones we tend to call subordinates. Now, it seems fairly obvious. Being dominant is good, right? You get listened to. You're in charge. You make decisions. Well, you also probably, if you're dominant, get more resources, have better opportunities. So being dominant is good, right? Why would you possibly want to be a subordinate? Why don't these social structures just, if everyone can't be dominant, why does anyone take part? Well, being dominant comes with perks. But there's also risks. So yeah, others are listening to you. If you say, do this, you're dominant, others probably will. But if your decision results in something, let's just call it, quote-unquote, bad happening, who gets blamed? Well, the dominant individual, the one that made the call, right? So there's risks here. No one generally is trying to knock a subordinate out of their subordinate social position, right? If you're going gunning for somebody, it's like, woohoo, I want to stay at exactly the same level I am. I'll take one of my peers. No, who are you going after? Who are you gunning for? You're gunning for someone who's higher on the social status than you are. Somebody in the office. You don't go after, your coworker's job. You try to move up the ladder in office hierarchy, which means going after someone above you. So, pros and cons to this. So being a subordinate, well, you don't have to necessarily make all the hard decisions. You just perhaps have to worry about you and your immediate stuff. You can more easily pass the buck. I don't know, I just do what I was told. Well, who told you to do that? He did. Okay. tend to get it. Subordinates tend to get into fewer fights. Right? If you're subordinate, you know you're subordinate. You're not likely to get in a fight over it because really, you don't have the best stuff out there. But what you got's yours. Okay. Having a strong hierarchy, leaders and followers, having well-established hierarchical patterns actually reduces conflict in the long run. A good friend of mine is a professional dog trainer, and she works with some crazy dogs. She often gets pulled in when she actually likes this. She likes working with the really large dogs, the ones that can basically eat your head. But she's really good at this. But many of these really large dogs, I mean, what they've been bred for is aggression over hundreds of years and dozens of generations. They've been bred specifically to kill either people or other dogs or other animals. Okay, that takes a certain amount to control an animal like that. You need to have a very strong hierarchical dominant system. Now, factor in the fact that dogs, derived originally from, at least northern dogs, from wolf stock, already have this biologically evolved hierarchical system. You translate this into now domesticated dogs, they keep that. Dogs actually lead to, even not the dogs that are going to eat people, but even, a little poodle or something. They really get, what's the word I want to use? Oh yeah, wigged out. They get wigged out if they can't figure out what the hierarchical dominance is. Like, am I in charge? Am I not in charge? Dogs really need somebody to be in charge. If it's part of a dog pack, it'll be the alpha. They'll just do what they're told. If a dog is not the alpha, they're cool with that, as long as there is an alpha. Right? Dogs are happiest, whatever happy means, but I mean, when we look at this behaviorally speaking, they're less behaviorally disruptive in human families if the humans are definitely in charge. It's not that they won't love you. They will. They're dogs. Okay? If no one's going to step up and be the alpha, this is what leads to stress for dogs, because then the dog is trying to, it's like, well, no one else is doing it. I got to take care of this. Okay? We see this in human situations as well. If the leader is not leading effectively, whoever's leader, however they became the leader, the dominant individual is not being dominant, is not doing his or her job, this leads to stress amongst the subordinates. Well, the leader's not doing it. Someone's got to do it. And look at it this way, because if nobody's doing it, who's it affecting? Well, it's affecting the group, but you're part of that group, right? So it affects you. So we get back down to the individual as the level of selection. I mean, if the company falls apart, well, tough break for the company, but oh, wait a minute, you're employed by the company. How does this affect me? So someone's going to say, well, if the leadership's not doing it, either time to get out of the company and join a different one, or someone else has to do it. Take a look at politics, right? You go back and just even Canadian politics. The rise and falls of party. We can look at leadership processes. Take a look at what happened to Paul Martin. Okay, Chrétien eventually leaves, pretty unwillingly, drags it out as long as possible, makes Martin's leadership come off weak, indecisive, because, in fact, Chrétien was still sniping at Martin as Martin takes over as liberal leader. And look what happened to the Liberals in the near future. And Martin's leadership came to a rather abrupt end. Take a look at what happened in Alberta with Stelmach, right? I mean, like or hate Ralph Klein, Klein at least kept a pretty tight control on his cabinet. Maybe not the brightest intellectual guy around, but politically, in terms of Machiavellian intelligence, Klein was brilliant at this. Stelmach? Not so good. If this was any other province, right, any other province, the Conservatives would probably not be getting back in. But it's Alberta, so of course they will. Right? Alberta has a history of only having really one powerful party. This goes back into the Socreds and goes back the same way, and that party stays in power consistently for anywhere from 35 to 50 years. So, I mean, this is not going to change, all right? But, you know, there's something odd happening in our local environment until we get the sudden next big shift and we get an entirely new political structure that comes in. But Stelmach, I mean, Stelmach's on the way out. I mean, how long was he the leader? What, 2 and 3 years? 2 and 3 years, something like that? Did not establish strong dominance. Right? Okay. So, having a strong dominance system, having a system where everyone knows what they do, what they're supposed to do, who they report to, that actually reduces conflict. The group benefits. If the group is benefiting, the individual members of the group also benefit. That's the group you want to be part of. So, we've got a lot of evolutionary background on this. We are a social species. Okay? We have, if you will, evolved the processes for recognizing social rules and social cues. This leads to various behaviors. Egalitarian systems where everyone is equal, and despite the concepts of, you know, writers such as Marx and Engels developing modern communistic theory, looking at things, I don't think we're heading that way, or at least it's not a surprise that communist systems have not actually worked, at least when you hit the real world. Communal structures tend to break down once you get beyond your sort of ancestral tribal level of a few hundred people, because at that point, somebody needs to step up and organize a system. Somebody needs to take control. Not everybody can collectively make those decisions. Anyways, so again, as you go through things, as you get into other, you know, other psychology courses, social psych, cultural psych, you know, think about these issues of dominant systems. Think about hierarchical structure. Think about group stability benefits for individuals. These kind of hierarchical structures, they're not random. They occur for a reason. We can try to impose structure on a system, but structure that doesn't fit with things that are perhaps influenced by our species' evolutionary processes in the past tend not to be terribly effective systems. Have you ever wondered why in things like the military you often get family descriptors? You know, the general's the old man, or like the father figure. That fits. We understand that as humans. Go back to Shakespeare. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers from Henry V. Or more recently, the television series Band of Brothers. The concept of kinship within military units. The troops aren't necessarily in modern combat, even going back into Henry V's period, 14th century. They weren't actually closely related. But you adopt that structure. Of kinship. It's a hierarchical structure that makes sense for humans. We've evolved to work in this way. Okay. Sports teams follow very similar patterns. Okay. All right, so just wrapping up with that, and oh good, I've killed the system. Oh no, there it is. Okay. Let's see. Any questions or thoughts about that? None at all. Okay. Chapter 10 takes us into the evolution of language. First off, language is a form of communication, but not all communication is language. Pretty much all animals, as far as we know, even down to the microscopic, have the ability to communicate in some way. The communication may be very simple, but it's at least possible. Even non-animals, certain plants, for example, will communicate in various ways. Some chemical cues, these sorts of things. But in that case, in the case of the plants, it's very just innate, totally evolved, and generally very single topic specific or single use specific. At least once we get into animals, we can have communication that can take on a variety of forms. But in terms of language, this is, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say unique to humans. Wait a minute, what about Kanzi the signing chimp? It's like, or the lexicon using chimp? It's like, yeah, but I mean, you know, that took a lot of work. And, you know, it took years and years to train Kanzi's mom. And yes, he picked it up looking at mom. But frankly, his communication system is only about as good as a really stupid 2-year-old human. I mean, I'm not putting him down. I mean, for a chimp, it's pretty damn impressive. But, I mean, you compare this to humans, and in terms of, it's like, well, he can come up with completely novel statements. Depends who you talk to. The most generous you are, you know, the most sort of generous you can be with this, a non-human animal has come up with a 4-word sentence. If you're somewhat more critical, that might be 2 2-word sentences just strung together when we misinterpreted them. It's hard to say, but, I mean, can non-humans manage to communicate with human language? Yes. Do a lot of them? No. Is it easy? No. Does it take years of training? Generally, yes. Is it as fluent as humans are? No. So some capacity there, some chimpanzees, a bit with a few cetaceans. Alex, tragically now deceased, the gray parrot. But really, we're dealing with some. And frankly, you'll say, oh, there you go, gray parrots can do this. Well, some of the other parrots that Dr. Pepperberg has worked with, really, Alex was pretty spectacular on this. He was an exceptionally gifted gray parrot. Some of the other ones just don't really have the same kinds of levels. Some are good, but no other gray parrots have been found quite as good as Alex yet. So I think it's relatively safe to say that as a sort of evolved ability here, language is currently unique to humans, at least in sort of a naturally, biologically predisposed way. Which is not to say that we can't make use of non-humans to study issues of language. In fact, Dr. Sturdy in the department works with chickadee birdsong. The communications, the birdsongs have to be learned. They're not biologically regulated. So baby male birds that don't grow up hearing adult male birds singing their courtship songs don't do a very good job of it. They need that exposure. There's a critical developmental period there, in a similar way that humans have this language. So we certainly can use non-human models for this. But, I mean, you can't get a songbird to actually use that kind of courtship song to explain anything else. It's really very specific to courtship. And that's one of the hallmarks of language, is that you can use it to explain completely new, novel, unique, previously undiscovered things. Now, in terms of defining language, so what is language? Simplest form of this is it's a vocal auditory channel. Now, you go, wait a minute, what about sign language? It's like, yeah, okay. Again, generally a fairly invented process there. But I'm fine with that. If we want, I mean, sign language does in fact meet all the other basic criteria of language. So for most individuals, it's going to be a vocal system. For some, it may be a signing system, a gesturally based system. Okay. But so that's less important here. Here's the more important things. And if you take a linguistics, you know, I've got a background in linguistics, psycholinguistics, they'll go through this a lot. So I'm just kind of compressing this stuff right down here. Arbitrariness. The symbols don't inherently mean anything. If I say dog, dog has no specific meaning. You have to learn what that particular pattern of sounds means. In fact, in a different language, what we say in English is dog, only a different name for a dog. So they're arbitrary. If I decided to start teaching in fact, actually, there was somebody that tried to do this, decided to raise his child speaking Klingon. And, interesting. It ultimately didn't work. Fellow was a linguist, so he tried this as a little bit of an experiment there. It ultimately didn't work because the child wasn't being raised sufficiently, being given sufficient exposure to Klingon. And given that Klingon is an invented language, although a highly, a very well developed invented language, some points they're just, it was very difficult to find words that would explain things in the real world. Worked a bit. So, I mean, completely arbitrary. Things like Klingon weren't invented, totally invented language. Esperanto, totally invented language, also doesn't work. People don't speak Esperanto. I mean, you know what Esperanto is? So-called universal, be a new universal language, totally invented, designed back in the 60s to be a world language, language that everybody could speak, and if everyone could speak together and talk to one another, conflict would end. Nice idea, didn't work. Frankly, it's just too much effort for people to bother learning this. When you already have a language, you can talk to the people that are closest to you and around you most. So that one also was ultimately due to failure there. Okay, so arbitrary. Semanticity. Well, language actually means something. You could have a whole bunch of arbitrary symbols that don't mean anything in and of themselves and don't mean anything really at all. So that would not be language. Cultural transmission. Languages passed across generational bonds. Spontaneous usage. Children will just spontaneously begin using vocal language. They don't have to specifically be trained in it. They pick it up. They have to be specifically taught how to read and write, for example. But vocal language, spontaneous usage. Turn-taking, we shift back and forth between who's speaking. Duality, language sounds require ordering for sense. So the words have to be put in some sort of order to make sense. That is, they have a grammatical structure to them. Man bites dog, dog bites man. Same words, different sequence, different meaning. Displacement. With language, we can reference things that occur across time and space, past, present, future. So our structural dependence is linked in here with respect to duality, but more broadly, there's other aspects of grammar. And creativity. This is a big one. Language can be used to describe completely novel events. Other forms of communication cannot. So we got our components of language. We got a vocabulary, specific words that have specific meanings, and grammar, rules for sequencing the vocabulary. Now, by bringing grammar in, however grammar evolved, talk about it a little bit in a while, this really gives you the ability to combine these concepts in limitless fashion. Right? If something occurred that had never happened before, alien landing, suns exploding, black holes opening, who knows what, price of gas dropping down to 6 cents a liter. I mean, stuff that's never happened before. We can describe that with language. With completely new things, you can come up with words and ways of fitting them into a sentence. And in fact, authors have played around with this for a very, very long time, in fact, inventing new things and structuring them into the grammatical context of sentences and having people understand, or at least have an idea of what's going on. Lewis Carroll, for example, does this throughout through the Looking Glass and Alice in Wonderland books, where he comes up with poems that have all kinds of made-up words and sounds, but we still can ascribe some sort of meaning to them. All right. Now, from the perspective of academia, and specifically evolutionary psychology, here's a few of the big sort of questions. First, how language evolved. And if we go back a bit in time, this was really sort of more of the earlier kind of interest. So how did gestures evolve? And broadly, there's two schools of thought on this at the ends of the continuum and then things in the middle as well. First, gestural, that languages, vocal language, spoken language, came out of gestures. So that it began with pointing at things. So we go back and we looked at things we talked about, those theory of mind benchmarks. So shared attention, eye tracking, babies, children looking at things they're being pointed at, trying to use body language to communicate desires. You know, kids that wind up. So my 11-month-old is making sounds like, like this, and reaching with his arms when he wants up. So, you know, the isn't really up yet, but he says, does this, you know, pick him up and say, up, and he goes, up, up, right? You know, so combination there, right? There's a gesture, okay? So body language communication. Second, vocalization. The argument here is that vocal language evolved out of earlier non-hominid, non-homo forms of vocal communication. If we look at pretty much all mammals have some form of vocal communication, not language, but they make sounds, and you got a pretty good idea, at least broadly, what those sounds may be. Wolf packs have different howls that they use, different forms there. Horses, I mean, you can tell if a horse is happy to see or really pissed off at you by the kinds of sounds it makes, and also body language as well. Questions of how language, where did it come from? While this was sort of some of the very early, earlier approaches in terms of evolutionary psychology, this has been moved a little bit, not just evolutionary psychology, but sort of any sort of evolutionary approach to linguistics, psycholinguistics. This has kind of been moved on to a little bit of a back burner. So people that are doing this sort of thing, definitely are. But more in terms of evolutionary psychologists, most sort of modern, over the last 10 years or so, evolutionary psychology is more focused not on the how language evolved, it did somehow, but more of an issue of why language evolved. And this gets back into sort of the evolutionary psychology approach of things, is like, what's the adaptive nature? I mean, either gestural or vocalization perhaps could have had an adaptive structure, so it's hard to distinguish there. But from the point of view of saying, okay, is there an adaptation? Will it maladapt? How's that? And this gets into the why. We're going to take a look at three theories within evolutionary psychology that postulate adaptive structure for language. So Dunbar's what's called social gossip hypothesis, social contract interpretation, and what's called the Scheherazade effect. I'll talk briefly about some issues here of gestural theory too. Pretty much all the non-human primates use gestures. They point to things. They, you know, pound chests. They jump up and down. Okay. When we take a look at deaf human children, they will learn to sign readily. In fact, they will communicate gesturally. If they are not exposed to a sign language, they will just gesture for things spontaneously. I mentioned this, I think, a little bit earlier, talking about some things with mirror neurons, but aimed throwing. If we take a look at the brains of things like macaques and baboons and whatnot, and at issues for fine motor control, even in humans, the centers for fine motor control and language, the speech centers, Wernicke's and Broca's, are usually both over on the left brain. Okay, so in humans, we've got both our fine motor control for throwing things and our language centers, in most humans, not all, but in most, over on the left, in the left hemisphere. Now, you go, okay, so what? Well, things like fine motor control, I mean, gestures, right? I need to do this kind of thing with my hand here. Being able to throw a spear or a rock. So, hunting. We know that our ancestors have been hunting for a very long time. So, this is, maybe these things are going together. Good manipulation of tools. Sorts of things. Again, perhaps going together here. Then we bring in the mirror neurons. So let's come back to the mirror neurons here. If we take a look at the premotor cortex, called F5, in the macaque, usually use the Japanese macaque, the mirror neurons in the F5 will fire when they observe somebody else's hand movements and during the same hand movements there. Now, when mirror neurons were first being discovered back in the mid to late 1990s, the sort of first bridge of this, the way that these mirror neurons came into evolutionary psychology, was sort of being exposed to this, was with respect to language issues. Gestural, proponents of gestural theory of language hopped on the screen and said, aha, you see, here's how it works, here's how you learn gestures, right? The macaque's doing this, has these mirror neurons for hand movement, and clearly then, ancestors would have had the same thing. F5 over on the left, well, does that correspond to any human? That's Broca's area. If you were to say, here's the macaque monkey brain, so expand it up to human size and kind of map it onto the human. Macaques F5 kind of overlaps pretty nicely with the human Broca's area. So, you see, evolution just turned our ancestral fine motor control into the language systems, and that's because of all the gesturing. So modern vocal language comes from earlier aimed throwing. Now, there's a few problems with this. First, it's a pretty big jump to go from gesture. So if all the early communication was coming out of gestural body language, to leap to speech. Okay, so to have a suddenly go to a vocal system. Outside of sign languages, gestures are not especially good for conveying concepts or ideas. Okay? So gesture me the idea of social responsibility. What's that gesture? I don't know. No, wait, that's a different one. I bite my thumb at you. No, wait, that's a different one, too. It's from the day of Shakespearean quotes. It's hard to do, right? So, limitations there. Brain lateralization, cross-species brain lateralization is not necessarily going to indicate common origins, right? We get a very different underlying neural circuits involved here. And so, going from a macaque brain, the F5 macaque, and say, well, that's going to be the same as, you know, our Broca's of humans. Look, you got to go back, you know, some 20-odd million years until we get back to a common ancestor, 15, 20 million years, between modern humans and modern macaques, right? There's an awful lot that could have happened over that time period. So to suggest that these are coming from the same brain areas is a bit dicey. More recent work, so after the, you know, after 2000 there, work in mirror neurons shows that they're actually in lots of different places, and they do a lot more than just motor function. That's where the first ones are being found in the macaque subjects. But we've got mirror neurons for all kinds of things, all kinds of observational work, not just gestural. So again, that we can't really use this to support the idea specifically that the mirror neurons first evolved for gesture-based learning and then this readily translated into language, spoken language. Now, that being said, you know, these sort of issues here doesn't mean that both gestural and vocal communication couldn't have evolved up in some sort of parallel, right? I mean, even going into the you know, non-human mammals there, and yeah, they've got, you talk about body language of a dog or a horse or whatever you want, and we can also talk about vocal communication that not only makes sounds, they also have body posture. That it all conveys information. It's all communication. So these two systems could just have been evolving along in parallel. It doesn't necessarily mean that one was a precursor of the other. I mean, if you really want to take this back far enough, I mean, the main areas of communication were chemical, right? Chemical releases, molecular olfactory signals. So, at that level, should we really be arguing, you know, and this gets into this issue of reductionism, good reductionism, bad reductionism. Well, okay, you go back to, say, lower vertebrates, or even the invertebrates here, and much of their communication is carried on olfactorily. So does that mean that we should trace our, you know, humans' language capacity back to our ability to sweat and release scent molecules? Oh, you're communicating with me right now. Yeah. Hey, how far do we reduce this? Right. So, issues there. Vocalization. You know, just as many non-humans have body language, gestural communication, non-human primates have elaborate vocalizations. We can describe this as both being prosodic and semantic content, so they can refer to very specific things, and they can actually sequence particular forms of vocal communication together. So the prosodics can just be, say, like states of excitement, calmness, these sort of things. Semantics can refer to particular types of events here. It's the semantics that become most significant with respect to language. So if you can use different communications to link into particular things, oh, you know, food is here, oh, predator is in the area, predator is closer, predator is right at the base of my tree, they start to become fairly particular, fairly specific. Now, you know, from that point, once you've evolved that kind of capacity for semantics, even if they're very innate, predisposed, almost hardwired forms of semantic communication, it's not perhaps a huge step to evolve that into now combining our semantics in different ways, that is, development of grammar, now giving a huge versatility to language. There's also what sometimes we call the singing argument for vocalization. Many of the non-human primates will utilize group, the group will get together and make the same vocalization, or essentially a very similar vocalization at the same time. And one possibility is this will synchronize emotional states. So we get into theory of mind. If you've got an injured, you know, if a monkey has injured itself somehow, the other monkeys come around, and if the injured monkey is making a sort of keening, wailing sound, the others often will do this as well. Well, think about this. If you are hurt, you're like, ow, 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 and cry, if that generates, you know, if there's your emotional state right there, okay, well, if others make the same sounds, this can put them into the same emotional state, a theory of mind issue, an empathy process. Oh, yes, I understand what you're experiencing, because when I make this sound on my own, it's because I'd be injured as well. So you go that way, this starts bootstrapping the social interactions up. This starts leading to increases in empathy. This could be the precursors of development of complex theory of mind. So interesting issues there. We also have what are called contact calling choruses in the non-human primates, often either at morning or in the evening, depending on the species, whether the more diurnal or nocturnal. They'll do these choruses, and this is serves to bring the group back together and let everyone know where they are. Humans do this as well, the singing, right? If you've got a child and the child has fallen down and gotten injured, right, you pick the child up and if the child's kind of whimpering or crying, it's not uncommon for the adult to sort of make a similar sound, you know, kind of a cooing sound or whatnot. So we see similar things there. I'm just going to talk briefly, as a means of example here, about these little guys called galogos, also called bush babies, more commonly called bush babies, but more technically the galogos. These are nocturnal African arboreal primates. They run from little guys about yay big, mouse or gerbil size, up to about like this. Kids keep them. Kids keep the larger ones, kind of like we keep cats as pets. So you can have a bush baby as a pet. Not all of them make especially good pets, but some do okay. Just from this picture here, you know, you see a couple of them there. Big eyes, long dexterous fingers, long tails. So they're generally nocturnal. As primates go, they're fairly old or low, if you will, on the evolutionary sort of hierarchy of primates. The Galogos, you know, what's led to the modern Galogos branched off a fair ways back, so they're more closer to tarsiers than they are to monkeys and apes. But still, they are primates. But ancestrally, fairly relatively. I want to say this. Ancestry, relatively primitive primates by this nature. Their social interactions are generally a bit less complicated than, say, monkeys, and definitely less complicated than apes. But the reason I want to use them as an example is because even though they're much simpler, they generally have brain size to body mass much, you know, smaller there, they've got some very interesting things in terms of communication. And so their vocal communication. So when we take a look at this, we can see that perhaps the precursors of modern vocal language, which we're probably most interested in, could have been going back a very, very long way. It doesn't take a large necessarily large brain size, cranial capacity to have very complicated vocal communications. And let me be clear, with the Galogos, we're talking about vocal communications. We're not talking about language. They do not have what human linguists would say is language. But they got some amazing vocal communications. So just looking at, for example, the what's called the thick-tailed bush baby, has a series of very specific calls, do a variety of things, attract companions, repel rivals. In the case of the presence of predators, they start with what are literature described as, I've never heard these, but described as knocking sounds, so I'm assuming some sort of a kind of clucking kind of sound. As the predator gets closer, that shifts into squawks, and if the predator is really close, it moves into what's descriptively called as a whistle yap. Now, just from the sort of descriptors here, this probably gives you a sense that, you know, the knock is perhaps not terribly, I mean, it might get your attention, but, you know, compare that to a whistle yap. If, you know, I said, Bo, the person suddenly whistle yapped, it's like, okay, something just happened, something important, right? Knocking doesn't sound quite as, you know, must get attention right now. The loudness and the pattern of the calls convey information to other thick-tailed bush babies, not necessarily to other species of bush babies, incidentally. Very species-specific here. But, you know, so just dealing with these knocks to squawks to whistle yaps, it's telling other bush babies in the area, oh, there's a predator here. It's also telling the predator. It's like, boom, you've been spotted, right? Now, this is an interesting cross-species form of communication, right? If the predator knows that he's been identified, he or she's been identified, should he keep stalking the bush baby, or should he give it up as a bad deal, save energy? It's like, ah, bush baby knows I'm here. Go try to find an unsuspecting bush baby to eat. So, the calls distinguish the nature of the threat. I mean, it's a predator. It's not like, woohoo, I found bananas or fruit or something. Ah, being attacked by a peach. Oh, no. Well, not a peach, but, you know. So the nature of the threat here and the distance by the type of call and the intensity. If the bush baby actually gets attacked, it switches into what's described as a yell, and, in fact, this will often bring other bush babies to help. I'm not exactly sure what... I mean, if we take a look at these things, right? I mean, can you imagine being, you know, I don't know, a panther or something being attacked by bush babies? Crocodile hunter, blanking on his name right at the moment, but, you know, now dead, killed by a stingray. But I remember watching an episode where he's in Africa, and it's... good guy. Sometimes his television show was a bit hokey, but, you know, he had, like, his native guide, you know, dressed up in colorful native garb sort of thing, and the bar guy's walking along with him. I'm sure it's like it's... You know, I'm sure the guy was thinking, you know, it's like, I'm glad he's paying me and, you know, like Western currency, because, you know. Anyway, so he's out there and he's found like a bush baby in the tree, and it's like, you know, it's like, ah, Cricky, look at this one. Oh, it's a great one. He's, you know, the bush baby's just in the tree, and it's like, you know, it's, you know, making a clucking sound at him, sort of thing, and like trying to sort of get, and he's grabbing the branch and pulling it down and pointing things out at him. And finally, the bush baby just has enough of this, like leaps on his head. Just, you know, and, you know, just spinning around this bush baby, just hammering on his, you know, grabbing his head, yanking on his hair, probably peeing on him, I don't know. But, you know, his native guide is just kind of standing there very impassively watching all of this happen. And got this, you know, mental thought that it's like, yeah, you know, you mess with a bush baby, that's what's going to happen. Just wait for the rest of them to show up, you know. Anyways, I'm not exactly sure how effective they are at, you know, combat. But anyways, we'll bring other bush babies to help. All right. Other kinds of calls with the thick-tailed bush baby. There's specific ones for juveniles. So these are buzzing call if they've been separated from mom. Humans do this as well. Human children, infants, have an alarm call. If you've never heard it, if you have kids, you will. It's very hard to miss, but it's like, I've been left at the base of a tree! Come get me! If you don't know where I am, I'm right here! And I'm going to make it very hard for you to ignore me. The thick-tailed bush babies have about 18 identified distinct calls. Each can have up to 5 meanings, depending upon frequency of repetition, intensity, so loudness, these sorts of things. They also get into sort of the physical location or locale or environment in which the call is being given. So if they're in close quarters, they use a high-pitched call. This can be used for requesting social contact. Low-frequency calls are actually used to communicate over a longer distance. Low-frequency wavelengths are larger, longer. They will actually wrap around things. So think about things like whales. Cetaceans said, oh, you know, whales can communicate over several thousand kilometers. They can. These are like very low-frequency waves. They just, the waves are so big, the frequency of them, they just go around things and over things and, you know, pass over and around other whales and dolphins and fish and whatnot. High-frequency calls, high energy, short wavelength, easily blocked by trees, branches, rocks, things like that. So high-pitched, high-frequency is better if you're in close. Interestingly, there's differences between the species in terms of their calls here. So the Allen's Gologos, for example, tends to live down low, dense undergrowth. They predominantly use low-frequency calls. They evolve this way. I mean, they're down in the undergrowth. There's a lot of stuff that's going to block a high-frequency call. They don't tend to use them. The elegant Gologos, by comparison, live up on the tops of trees in the canopy. They tend to use more high-frequency calls. There's very little up on the top of the trees that's going to get in your way. So those can communicate over a distance that way. Real species differences. The Allens and the Elegant, I mean, one can be at the bottom of the tree, the other at the top of the tree. They really can't communicate with one another. They're using very different forms. The way that primatologists that study Gologos communication work is they tromp out into the jungle, usually at night, and they carry just sound recording equipment with them. and then when they take the sound, run it through a visualizing process on the computer, they get what are called sonograms. So over there on the right, those are pictures, the visual representations of the frequency and intensity of the sound waves, so sonograms. If you will, these sometimes described as vocal fingerprints. On my garage band here on the computer that is recording the dulcet tones of my voice. For you as a podcast, there's a little sonogram depictor down at the bottom there. So let's turn this around quickly. And just down there, that's the sonogram of me talking. How very exciting this is for you, I know. Anyways, so we can do this. Now, if you get used to the various logos that you're studying, people that work with these can actually identify the species by looking just at the sonogram representations. They can also identify, people that are good at this, can identify different what we call dialects. So same species, but perhaps coming from different parts of a geographical range. Now, we see this as well in things like chickadees. There's a number of different species of chickadees in North America, about 7 or 8 of them. But even within a species, they can cover a very large, birds can cover very large geographical areas. You get local dialects. So if you capture some chickadees from one area, maybe 1,000 kilometers away, and bring them up here, then males may not be particularly good at courting the local Albertan chickadees because they may have a slightly different dialect. The courtship song may not be perfectly understood. Or maybe it's going to be very, very sexy, right? Dialects, you know, it's like, yeah, it's that European dialect, no, it's very foreign, it's an accent, you know. Could be hot, I don't know. Chickadees, who knew? Now, some interesting stuff has come out of this. So, for example, you combine the sonogram up with the physical, morphological structure of the Gologos, and there's some cool things. So the dwarf Gologos of West Africa, relatively obviously small here, used to be thought of as just one species. Turns out it's actually two. They've now been renamed into what's called the Thomases, Gologos, which lives up in the canopy, and the Dimadophs, which is down low. Morphologically, physically, physiologically, they seem to be the same. I mean, if you had the skeletal systems of a Thomas's and a Dimadophs, you really couldn't tell them apart. Skulls are the same, teeth are the same, everything's more or less the same. But they use different communications. Their sonograms that are recorded are different. What that means is they're not communicating with each other. Now, this is one of the interesting things. We talk about speciation. Okay, well, speciation just means the inability of individuals to successfully interbreed. Now, we often think of that as like, well, yeah, a dog can't really mate with a cat. Well, you're not going to get puppyittens out of that. Puppins? I don't know. You know, some sort of weird half-dog, half-cat thing. It doesn't happen. You know, you occasionally get, what is it, horses and donkeys. Is that how you get the mule or the... Yeah, horse, donkey, but generally sterile and, you know, so we have a few of these cases here, right? But it's like, no, what we're really saying here is in terms of communication. So, look, if you can't communicate with one another, it's pretty hard to get into a courtship relationship here. What's he saying? I have no idea. Maybe he wants to borrow money. I don't know. You think he's trying to see if you want to go on a date? Beats me. What are we talking about? Okay. So, in fact, there's been a good deal of speculation by evolutionary biologists over a rather long time that changes in communication may precede morphological speciation events. For example, we're probably seeing a speciation event occur with killer whales right now. Well, not right now, because there are no killer whales in the real, but I mean off Vancouver Island. So, of course, seeing this is going to take a really long time. Come back in about 10,000 years and we'll see what's happened here. But there's populations of killer whales that basically are residences. They stay off the coast of Vancouver Island more or less year-round now. And then there's the transient migratory ones that do these long migrations from north to south every year. They use different forms of communication. They don't actually communicate with one another terribly well. They're using different calls. Now, if that's the case, you're not going to get a lot of interbreeding between them. Gradually, if this continues, probably for another 5 or 8 or several thousand, 500... 1,000, 2,000 generations of killer whales, we might start to see through gradual buildup of mutations, crossover events, inbreeding effects, whatnot, that physiologically they actually start to change. They no longer physically both look like current killer whales. So that communication could precede a morphologic speciation event as well. In terms of how many species of Gologos are there, well, based on recent work in terms of communication, it seems that there's probably over 40. In fact, some of these species are only known from their sonograms. They've never actually physically been seen. Because, you know, they're up in trees that may be a few hundred feet tall, and it's dark. And our ancestors were arboreal at one point, about 5 million years ago, but now, honestly, we're not as good at it as the Gologos are, but getting around in the trees. So some of these have just never been caught. They've only been heard. Okay. So my point of all this was we can have some very complicated forms of vocal communication in some relatively small-brained primates. But even going back to these Gologos, which come from a fairly ancestral line of primates here, quite complicated. So, you know, if we take our ancestors back, you know, even 5 million years when, you know, back to our early Australopithecines, they almost certainly would have had a vocal communication system that was at least as complicated as what we see in the Gologos, possibly more so. Is it language? Probably not at that point in time, because Australopithecines are, in terms of brain size, cranial capacity, relatively close to modern chimpanzees. Modern chimpanzees do not actually have a native language, but they do have a very complex form of communication. But there's probably our precursors for this. Now, let's take a look at human speech. Let's shift over to people at this point. very good for information exchange. We've been doing this all term, conveying a lot of information through speech. It's not especially good at conveying things like emotional states or feelings. To get into that, we often have to default to metaphors, similes, analogies, all right? This is perhaps why we revere certain human poets. And by poets, I'll also include, say, musicians. Song is really a form of poetry, often free verse, but not always. People that are good at conveying emotion can become very, very popular entertainers, right? Country music, the saddest music in the world, right? Me doggy went and died. My girl took my pickup. I can't even do it, right? I'm not sad enough. I'm not sad enough to sing country. I mean, people talk about the blues, but I mean, really, that's nothing compared to some old cowboy sitting on his horse. Well, he doesn't even have the horse anymore. The dog ran off with it. I mean, tragic. Okay, so metaphor is often used. You know, how do you feel? I feel like someone ripped my heart out of my chest. So you feel like you're dead? Well, no, but I wouldn't feel anything. Oh, so you feel like you're in the need of like some sort of bypass? Well, no, that would be... You're ruining the experience here. Sorry. Human-style grooming. We do this. So sad, you just need a hug. Right? Non-human primates, you know, contact, they'll get together. You often see non-human primates, you know, like, doing this stuff. You ever see any nature shows, you know, picking away at one another's fur, grooming. It's like, oh, see, they're eating all the bugs. Non-human primates are disgusting, dirty creatures. And it's like, no, not really. I mean, if they find a bug, they'll probably eat it. But, I mean, most of it's just contact comfort, right? We'll come back to that in a little bit. But, you know, sometimes it's like, you just can't explain what you're experiencing. That's when that human-style grooming comes in, the contact comes in. Now, what we probably can say here in terms of human language is that this would have been evolutionarily selected. It's so uniquely specific to humans. There had to be something. It could not have occurred just by random chance. As far as we know, there is not a single language gene. It's not like somehow there was a chance mutation millions of years ago and bam, everybody after that had language. Now, if that single gene mutates off in a different direction, you do not have language at all. It doesn't work that way. There's many, 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 many genes that are directly, peripherally, tangentially involved in language usage. When we look at the processes of language production and comprehension, just even from strictly, let's ignore the behavioral side of this, but just from a neurological perspective, it is very expensive. So we take a look here, we have large portions of the brain, and I've just sort of highlighted broadly a few areas. We've got motor projection areas that are involved in speech, big chunk of the motor cortex that's involved in working our lips and our tongue and our mouth and all of this. We've got Broca's area. I mean, these are just like spots. I'm not trying to represent actually the physical amount of area of the brain they take. And in different people, there'll be slightly different locations, right? You do know that not everyone's brain looks exactly the same, yeah? The folds are in slightly different locations. So when we have these sort of standardized neuropsychology textbook pictures of brains, these are really just representations. Everyone's brains are a little bit different there. Anyways, so, you know, Broca's somewhere off over in here. Wernicke's generally a little bit behind over here somewhere. Then we got our auditory cortex that comes in. So there's a lot of chunks of brain that are actually involved in language. Neurologically speaking, that's expensive. There's also some other costs that are involved. You can't swallow and breathe at the same time. People choke on things. It's often when they're trying to talk with their mouth full. This is tough to teach kids, right? So stop talking with your mouth full. See? You see what happened? See? I told you. Did you listen to Dad? Oh, wait a second. Okay, there. Now, what do we learn from that experience? I know, I sound like a horrible father. Okay. But, right? It's a risk. It's you know, it's definitely a risk. There's also a cognitive delay, or we might call distraction. was speaking, we talked about this a little bit. I've talked about the issues of, you know, collisions occurring when talking on cell phones and whatnot. I mean, that's cognitively taxing, especially if you're having a conversation with someone that you're not around. You're losing all kinds of feedback. But even so, you know, those, I do this quite frequently. I'll toss them, I know, it's kind of annoying. I recognize this for many people, probably for my students, when I'll drop into these, when I'm talking, when I'm lecturing. There, I just did it. Now I'm going to do it again. I can't stop doing it now. Okay, this is embarrassing. No, part of this is, it used to be, there was actually some interesting research on this, indicating that what's happening in those little pauses that people interject into the communication is they're involved in formulating what you're going to say next. So it's actually a cognitively, if you will, thoughtful period of generating your next statement, as opposed to just blah, 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 spewing whatever comes out of your mouth first. People that just blah, blah, spew things out may sound like they have no problems speaking or communicating, but in fact, these may not be particularly ponderous thoughts. So there's actually these little pauses, these little inserts that are set in there into language. Not everyone uses them, but many people do. Are indicating, just at home, that you're generating the next thought, and those little pauses that are placeholders indicate, I'm not done speaking yet. I'm just trying to think of what I'm going to say next. Right? My daughter does this frequently now. She'll hopefully get better at it. She gets older, but it's like she has words. She has something she wants to say. But she's still trying to figure out exactly where the concept is going. So she'll not infrequently just repeat the same thing over and over a few times while her brain is grinding out the next thing she's going to talk, and then she drops into the next statement and then does that a couple of times. And, you know, it's especially in her case just a, my brother's been getting some attention for a while, I want some attention, I don't really know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to force you to listen to me. People do this sort of thing. So these cognitive, but there's a cognitive delay there. If you're actually trying to say, come up with things. And I mean, in my case here, I'm not reading, as you probably figured out, I'm not reading off a specific script or whatnot. I mean, I've got these things that give me vague guidance, but I don't follow when I'm lecturing. I'm not reading a paper. I have actually been in classes where professors would completely prepare their lecture and simply read the lecture. No ums or pauses or anything in there. Beautifully grammatically structured. Wonderful arguments, all worked out in advance. But you might as well just buy it as a book and read that and not go to class. So I do this in a somewhat different way. I don't always know exactly what I'm going to say when I'm up here. My examples come, like, I didn't plan on talking about my daughter's placeholder sounds there. It's like, oh yeah, here's an example I can use. So these little pauses. So we see that trying to generate language can be cognitively difficult. It is expensive from this perspective. It is not the easiest thing to do. From an evolutionary perspective then, if there are these various costs, if it can kill you, if it's distracting, if you, and when you're engaged in, we've talked about this earlier as well in terms of our cognition. If you're engaging in something that's cognitively taxing, you might be missing other things. If you're focused on trying to convince somebody about something, you might miss the predator running towards you. Trade-offs, right? So if we've evolved something that has these various costs, then you gotta say, well, there's got to be some sort of benefit to it. So what could the benefits be? Well, could be a variety of things. Multitasking. You can do a variety of things at once. If you were just communicating with gestures, can't do anything else with your hands while you're doing that. But you can talk to the person. You don't even need to be visually attending somebody. You can be talking to someone who's behind you or talking to someone in the dark when you can't see them. Okay? Might be harder to do, but it can still be done. Those are some pretty big potential benefits here. You can communicate over distance with this. Most of our conversations are pretty close proximity, but I mean, you can be yelling at something at somebody who's around the side of a hill, or you're in the front yard of a house, they're in the backyard of the house, these sorts of things. So again, there's various advantages in there. Now, in terms of learning language, why don't we come back to this in about 10 minutes? Okay? So, take a break and then come on back.